You're listening to the Busy Creator Podcast, episode 96, with guest David Power. Hello and welcome to the Busy Creator Podcast from busycreator.com. This is the show that explores the tools, techniques, and habits you can use to become your most creative, productive self. From New York City, I'm your host, Prescott Perez Fox. This is episode 96 of the Busy Creator Podcast, and today I'm speaking with David Power, who is a fellow Brooklynite and an all-purpose creative busybody. David is really doing a ton of different things, as we'll hear, including in the areas of film and video, which is something I personally have had very little exposure to, and his backstory is interesting, so stay with us. A very chill conversation coming up, but I think you'll enjoy hearing David's perspective and experiences. The bandwidth for this episode is provided by Freedcamp.com, the official project management tool of The Busy Creator. Thank you to Freedcamp for being an excellent project management system and for sponsoring the bandwidth of our show. And as is our custom, the show notes for this episode are available online at busycreator.com/96 for episode 96. And that's where we'll have all the links, book recommendations, quotations, and contact details. You can also see the show notes by tapping the album artwork in most mobile podcast players. So if you're on the go, check out the show notes from your phone. Okay, let's get right into the conversation with David Power. I sat down with him at his home studio, also in Brooklyn, New York. All right, are we recording?
We are.
Okay, David, thanks for inviting me over. I would say thanks for joining me, but I feel like I'm joining you.
You're quite welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk about the space that we're in and kind of paint the picture. This is kind of a multifaceted office / recording studio. I see musical instruments. I see computers. I mean, what goes on here?
What goes on here? To the extent I can discuss it in mixed company, I'm going to call it a mixed use room.
Uh-huh.
And it's not large. It's 10 by 10. I do have the walls and ceiling treated with professional acoustic paneling. And that really helps. Before I did this, it really wasn't a usable room for listening or recording. Now it's by no means perfect, but it's much, much better, as I think you can attest.
Yeah. As soon as I walked in, I was like, oh, this sounds very different than the rest of the apartment here.
Yeah. You know, it sounds a lot better than it did.
Absolutely.
And better than every other room in the house.
So. Okay. And what are these panels? I mean, did you make these or did you purchase them? Are they space age polymer foam that NASA used? I don't know.
I bought them from a company called GIK Acoustics.
Uh-huh.
And I think if memory serves, they're located in Atlanta, Georgia. These panels are wood frame, I think pine wood frame, and they have between 2 and 4, depending on the model, 2 and 4 inches of fiberglass, high density fiberglass. They're designed to sit between 4 and 6 inches from the wall, and they basically deaden any sound waves that move through them. And then the reflection that comes back from the wall is also deadened to the same degree. So they really take the energy out of the sound waves. And
yeah.
So I have them on the walls, in the corners, and on the ceiling. Yeah. And they really help a great deal.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I'm trying to paint that picture for folks at home that these are not covering 100% of the surface area of the wall and the back of the door. They are sort of suspended randomly. It's almost the way you decorate. If these were artwork, it'd be like, oh, they're just hanging on the wall. They're just here and there. And you can still see the paint. You can still see the door frames and everything like that.
Yeah. And it's important to maintain some of the natural reverb in any given room. You
okay.
don't want to cut it all down and turn it into an anechoic chamber, because then it sounds really super weird. So you do want to leave some of the wall exposed. The worst offenders in any room are the corners. So to the extent you can cover the corners, and those are typically the biggest offenders sonically in any room.
Okay. So let's back up just a second, because so we described the room, but what sort of work do you do that requires a room such as this?
Excellent question. I do in this room a little bit of everything.
Right.
And that includes recording and editing a podcast. And doing some audiobook work. I do my writing in this room. Of course, I do that. So it's fairly quiet when I write. I do a fair amount of video editing. Filmmaking is another love and passion of mine. A little bit of music. I haven't done so much recently, but I do love creating and producing music as well. So it's very much a, a multimedia room.
And then you mentioned you were working on a short film as well. So are you behind the camera? Are you doing the visual side of it as well as all the audio stuff you just mentioned?
The short film I mentioned, I didn't qualify that. It was actually a friend who directed that film a couple of years back.
Okay.
So I was involved in I like to make the joke when he's around that my creative contribution was providing the set.
Okay.
So I don't have any active film projects right now, but I do film. I do cinematography myself, and yeah. I edit that work and compose scores for that work as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was asking. So that's crazy. So how did you get into doing everything? I mean, did you start from a particular field? You're a trained blank, and then you've branched out from there?
No. The more elaborate answer to that question is that I, for a number of years, have loved music. So I started playing guitar when I was a teenager, and from there taught myself some keyboards without ever having taken a lesson from anyone. Shortly after I moved to New York City in 2007, I decided I wanted to make films. I'd never made a film before. I decided I wanted to make films. So I spent 1,000 hours learning, like just figuring out what gear I needed. And then I bought that gear and I started making films. And it was kind of a progression. I started out making short comedy videos, starring myself. Mm-hmm. Not that I ever had or have now an aspiration to be in front of the camera, but it was convenient. I was always available when I was available.
Yeah.
So that worked out nicely. And I worked with a writing partner whom I had met in a stand-up comedy class. So we'd get together on weekends, we'd work out sketches, and we'd walk around New York City with a camera and shoot ourselves doing ridiculous things and turn it into a short film.
Okay.
So, a lot of them actually were music videos, comedy music videos, very much like the SNL digital shorts.
Right.
The Lonely Island guys would do, with Andy Samberg and co.
Sure. What are they? The Chronicles of Narnia? And what are the other ones? I can't even remember off the top of my head, but.
What were some of the other ones they did?
Tick in a Box.
Tick in a Box. Yeah. It was that style of comedy.
Yeah. Okay. I want to see if I can dig those up. Do you still have them online?
They're not widely available. They would be available to you. I can make a link available to you, but okay. They're not kind of available to the public.
All right. Yeah. That'd be great to include that. I want to see what this all was, in fact. But now we talked earlier about your most recent project that you're sort of podcasting the production of a feature film. Is that accurate?
Yes, correct. Yes.
And that sounds pretty cool. What's your involvement in the film before we get into your involvement in the podcast thereof?
Yeah, so my involvement in the film goes back almost 6 years now. Mm. I met another filmmaker whose name is Michael Goldberg in, I think, 2008, 2009. We were screening films at the same festival in New York City. It was the Iron Mule Comedy Film Festival. It's a monthly screening series. And we had independently screened films. We ended up chatting at the end of the evening. We would run into one another frequently at these screening events, and we ended up working on a project together. I wrote it, he directed it, we edited it together, and we worked really well together. So several months later, he decided he was going to start working on a feature film script called Surefire, and he invited me to be part of the writing group.
Yeah.
And he put together a team of five guys, all of whom were comedy writers, and we spent at least a year and potentially a little longer working on this feature script. Over time, people got busy for one reason or another. Everyone, one at a time kind of peeled off the project, and he was essentially at, the end of the year left alone without a completed script.
All right.
Now, when I say incomplete, it was 250 pages. So it was a very long script. There was plenty of material to work with, but it wasn't complete in the truest sense of the word. So he subsequently took that project off on his own and got other writers involved. Fast forward 3 or 4 years, he has a final script he's happy with. We have stayed in touch during that time. I no longer have a credit on the writing of the script, but earlier this year, he and his co-producer launched a crowdfunding campaign on Seed and Spark, mm-hmm. which is a film-based crowdfunding platform. They came to me and asked if I would help them put together a pitch video to film and edit the pitch video, as well as a mashup kind of update video several weeks later. But that was my involvement in that aspect of the project. They ended up making over 200% of their goal. So they were quite happy about that. And, you know, another of the ideas I pitched them at that time was, hey, you know, you've got a long road ahead of you, 12, 18 months or more. Wouldn't it be a good idea, or would it maybe be a good idea to have a podcast? And that kind of builds an audience, helps you build an audience by documenting the making of the film right from the very beginning. So we kind of went back in time to the original writing of the script and everything that had transpired to that point, and then into the crowdfunding campaign and how, you know, that played out. And now we've kind of moved into subsequent goings on. So the podcast is essentially an audio documentary of the making of a feature film called Surefire.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I'm still kind of puzzled about how real films get made and even written. Is there a process you followed? Is there a prescribed method that when you have an idea that you want to get it down, do you start with the acts, the three act structure, and then build the characters, or do the characters come first? And I mean, what's the methodology to even coming up with a movie idea and turning it into a script?
Excellent question. And I don't think there's one specific answer. I think it really depends on the writer or writers and where their idea emanates from. So for this particular film, the director, Michael Goldberg, he had an experience in which he was approached by a guy who claimed to be a movie producer. And he wanted Michael to work with him to write a script. And Michael thought, great, I'm in New York, I'm new in New York City. This is my big break. I'm working with a movie producer. And so the guy kind of strung him along for several weeks saying, yeah, you're going to get paid. You're going to get paid. And then, you know, he would buy him lunch one day. And then several weeks later, when Michael would say, hey, you know, we talked about money. And the guy would say, well, you remember that day I bought you lunch? And he kind of never came through with the money. So right. Michael was basically working for free for a number of weeks. And the guy was a little bit shady. He's, you know, That was pretty shady. Even Michael, looking back on it now, says when he originally met the guy, it was in a diner somewhere in Manhattan. And the guy, as he was explaining the idea to Michael, was kind of looking over his shoulder in a kind of shady fashion. So that should have tipped him off, you know, from the outset, but didn't. So yeah, for Michael, this particular idea, because he brought the idea for the script to the table, and it was largely based on that personal experience. So the characters for this story came out of his personal experience.
Okay.
In this instance, take the characters, start with the characters and build out the three act structure.
All right. I'm curious to hear as well about how you would co-write something, because I know that being familiar with documents, right, that it's tough to contribute on something that has like a linear flow the way a single document does. Is it that you write a piece and then someone else comes in and edits it, or is that you're writing different parts at the same time, and then when you sort of reach the middle, almost like a transcontinental railroad, you like reach the middle together and then you have to link up
and hope they meet?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not off by 4 miles. During the writing of the script, we went down several different paths, and I will say that it was one of the most fun experiences, like sitting almost every Saturday morning in a room with five guys, all of whom were very bright and funny, and just kind of pitching ideas at one another.
Right.
And the ideas we were pitching were of the nature, okay, this has just happened. What happens now? And what does this person say? And how does the other character react? That's kind of how we went with it. So we ended up with Michael taking notes of all the ideas that were thrown out at him.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting to a point at which he had dozens and dozens and dozens of pages of notes, perhaps enough notes to actually be a feature length script in itself. And then having to kind of wade through it and decide which ideas we were going to use and which we weren't. But the fun part of that was the fact that, you know, not only hanging out with smart guys, but the fact that everyone was trying to top one another. If someone would toss out a really great idea, a really funny idea, everyone would try to either embellish it or top it with their own ideas. And we ended up spending a lot of time laughing, which was really, really great fun.
Sure.
When we got to the point of actually starting to write the script, I think Michael did most of the actual transcribing of the notes. We did at certain points decide, okay, let you take a crack at this scene, which has, you know, a definitive start point and end point. You take a crack at this scene hey, David, you take this scene, Michael mm-hmm. will take this scene, et cetera. And then kind of join them up. There's always editorial kind of voice issues.
Yeah.
We tried, because we were all, you know, somewhat experienced writers, we tried to write with a common voice. And we kind of succeeded, but we ended up with the first draft of this film being, or the first draft of this script being what would amount to a 2.5 hour movie, which really was too long. We knew that going in.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So yeah, there were several different paths we went down.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think if you're starting with the characters, then that's kind of the rallying point, right? That you can imagine, oh, I don't think that person would say this. And yeah. You can picture it in your head. Everyone can picture the dialogue between those two characters. And yes, the construction of the phrases might be a little different, that, oh, this guy never uses contractions and this guy never says yo and or whatever it is. Like,
yeah,
that if it's a common character, then maybe that helps the writing, because everyone can put themselves in the same head.
It does. It absolutely does. And one of the things you typically do in the writing of a script is decide on your character's backstory.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily ever disclose this to the audience, but you kind of get an idea where this person grew up, what they did as a kid, where they went to school, how they speak, how they dress. And then those kinds of decisions help you form the way this character communicates and interacts with other people.
Yeah.
And you do your best to stick through with that kind of common thread throughout the entire script.
Exactly. Okay. And so all the while you're recording this in podcast form, or how are you tracking it all?
We are tracking it all. And, you know, we try not to go too deep into any one topic. I think the one episode we ended up breaking into two was specifically on the crowdfunding process.
Mm-hmm.
Because both Michael and Dave, the two co-producers, had encountered a lot of other directors and filmmakers in their travels who were interested in crowdfunding and how they might go about it themselves and how they might be successful. So because these guys were successful with their campaign, they thought it would be a good idea to kind of, you know, blow out all of the details around what they did, how they did it, and how they became successful, so that if other filmmaker friends wanted to try it, or even hopefully filmmakers they've never met who are fans of the podcast, would have a sort of a roadmap of how they can be successful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just published an article like that on The Busy Creator too, so we'll have that linked up. Yeah, it's interesting, because that might seem so obvious, like, oh, just ask your people for money. It's like, nah, there, you have to be strategic about it. You have to be careful about how you write it and how you present it. And, you know, if you look at Kickstarter or any of these other ones, the pitch video the donation video is almost its own weird kind of art form now. And just the way that a political ad has a certain feel and texture, the campaign video for some stupid gizmo now has a similar defining aesthetic as well.
Yeah. Just in terms of the crowdfunding, I think what was most noteworthy or surprising to both Michael and Dave was the fact that crowdfunding is, during the 30-day period you're doing it, is almost a full-time job. And then once you've gotten the money, there's almost another full-time job on the back of it, delivering all the goodies, what's the word they use?
The different tiers, right? The different gifts and that sort of thing.
The gifts, yeah, delivering the gifts. And one of the gifts for them, one of the gifts for this campaign was social media shout-outs. So instead of just saying, hey, Prescott, thanks, they actually would write something meaningful referencing your website and your work and your Twitter handle and your Facebook page, and like put some thought and effort into it.
Yeah.
But when you have hundreds of those to do, it's really time consuming.
Sure.
I think you can appreciate.
Yeah. We've had folks on the show talking about it. Catherine Lavery, she's done a number of successful projects on Kickstarter, but she cautioned us about that, about when you make your rewards tiers, you have to do something that, first of all, you can actually fulfill, because you can't say, oh, hey, I'm going to send you a handwritten gold plated, I don't even know, I'm just making things up. But it's like, even something like a t-shirt, it sounds good. Oh, well, include a t-shirt. It's like, well, now you're producing t-shirts that have a per cost overhead.
Exactly.
And then shipping them and everything else. So it can become a really convoluted project. And I think what's happening with crowdfunding specifically is that you're starting to see maybe what makes more sense is just like a 0 to 1. If you want it, give us money. And if you don't, then click away. But there's no tiers. We're not doing autographs. We're not doing bundles and posters. And we're not doing a Facebook group. Like, you just want the stupid poster or not. And I mean, I can I can kind of get with that. I think in that case, it's a little less likely for Kickstarter or whoever to feature you on their homepage. But
Probably, that's
about the only downside. For something like a book or a poster, once you get the unit cost, you can just go to print and pretty straightforward from that point of view. Whereas if the costs were changing as the project was unfolding, yeah, it can be kind of convoluted, I imagine. So, okay, so you crowdfunded it and all this stuff is going on and you're recording it. And were you doing this as well as like during the same time that you have client projects or you're doing some other type of work? So you're making movies and podcasts and fitting everything in like crazy?
At that point of the year, I was working a corporate job.
Uh-huh.
So my weekdays were spoken for. So this was all evening and weekend work.
Yeah. All right. That's further complications into the process, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how did the three of you communicate this whole time?
We communicated mostly using American Sign Language. No, all kidding aside, we would get together on a fairly regular basis. It was a little more difficult. One of the collaborators has a job. He works 12-hour shifts Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So he wasn't really available on weekends most of the time. But we were in constant communication over email. At one point, I set up a Trello board because I was editing the video, so I was getting a lot of feedback and notes from David and Michael. And that kind of worked. It only works if you stick to it.
Yeah.
But there's almost, it was, and I think anyone who's done, anyone who's tried this has probably a similar experience. When you're receiving notes on film or anything creative, and you're trying to keep track of the emails, at least in Microsoft Outlook, where there isn't kind of grouping of topics or anything like that, or discussion threads, it's easy to miss things.
Then
you end up driving yourself crazy, looking through old emails to find something you thought you saw, but may not have seen. So there was a lot of that going on.
Oh, definitely. I can relate. And I just had this conversation yesterday, actually, about how email is terrible. I mean, it's an ongoing conversation, but using a project management tool, you also have to establish the habits and the rules. That's a recurring theme on this show that I always say, if you have a really solid workflow that reflects the way you actually do projects, you could be able to change software almost over a weekend or something, right? Just sign up for a new title and make a new template. And yeah, there's a little bit of overhead, but you have to agree on common principles. So that could be things like, hey, if we're talking about a project, all the communication has to be in the project management tool. The only time we email is if we have an outside vendor or something like that. Another one could be, I mean, I know companies that have sort of banished internal email. They only use Slack. And the only time you email someone is, again, if it's outside the company or in a rare occasion where you're sending an attachment from one person to the other and it has to kind of have the permanence of an email, and then, which is kind of an ironic thing, of course. But if you're using Slack specifically, a lot of teams either don't have the pro version, so they only have 10,000 messages total, meaning your history is not there.
Okay.
But even if the history is there, I haven't had good luck storing files in Slack. I don't think it's for that purpose. Mm. So, another check. But yes, I feel your pain on that regard. And I think if I was setting up a movie, if I was writing a movie, that's like the first thing I would do is create a project management setup for that and let it go from there.
Yeah. And I think if and when I work with people this way in the future, I will definitely try to do that. Like I say, the Trello board worked reasonably well until one person didn't have it installed and decided to send an email one time instead.
Right.
And things kind of gradually fell apart, but it's great to have everything as you can appreciate, have everything in one place so you can kind of check things off as you go.
Yeah.
Cross them out.
And how about collaborative writing, like on a script specifically? Were you using a tool like Google Docs to see the changes of everyone? Or were you just coming to these Saturday morning meetings with like printouts and being like, here's what I did?
We started with handwritten notes.
Yep.
And at a later point, worked with printouts from Final Draft, which is the industry standard tool for script writing. So yeah, it wasn't, I'm trying to think if there was any other tools we used. I can't think of any at the moment. So it was pretty old school.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Is Final Draft, I'm not familiar with it firsthand, but I've heard of it before. Do they have those online features, those, iterative backups and collaboration and track changes, those type of things?
The most recent version I've worked with or know of, I know for certain it saves to Google Drive and Dropbox. Does it have full-on collaborative features. That I'm not certain of.
Okay.
It would make sense that it would, yeah. But I'm not certain if the most recent version has that yet.
Okay. That's interesting. I'm always toying with the idea of using Git to write documents. And
that's interesting.
Because, yes, it's not very user-friendly. And whether it's Bitbucket,
yeah,
and SourceTree is like the desktop version, or GitHub or whatever it is, or something you rolled yourself, like the technology, it is the most thorough way to collaborate on changes, especially plain text changes that you could edit something line by line and send it up, do a pull request, and the other person can read your changes and say, yep, I'll include that one, and they can merge it. And I mean, it's clunky, but I imagine that that would be the best way to maintain a single document. Because also, here's one thing that no one ever talks about, that you can use plain text anywhere. You could use it when you're connected to the internet, when you're on a plane, when you're in the subway. You know what I'm saying? It's on almost every device. And then if you can save it and then set it as a commit, like it's not instantaneous, but you can get that same synchronicity and that same collaboration.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know. I think a lot of these apps are prejudiced against New Yorkers because we spend half our life in a metal tube underground, far away from Wi-Fi.
Yep.
And, you know, so you've got to be thinking about, hey, I'm not always online. Like something like Google Documents, for example, you know, if you don't have a connection, you can't use it.
Does it not have an offline mode of any sort?
You know, maybe. I consider myself a smart guy. I've never been able to successfully research an offline version of Google Docs.
Right.
And because the files, like if you save a document, we're totally going down a software rabbit hole here, but
yeah.
You know, if you have Google Drive and you can navigate to where you save the document, it'll be in a file structure. It'll be in a folder. But if you double click it, it's really just a JSON link. So it's not a file on your hard drive in a conventional sense. It's really just a special kind of web link that sends you to the cloud document.
Gotcha.
So you would have to kind of hack your browser to have that same functionality as the Google Drive website, as the Google Docs website.
Yeah.
And I haven't done it yet. Someone's probably listening saying, oh my God, you guys just do a thing. And the same thing with Dropbox Paper, which is a relatively new technology as well. I like Dropbox Paper because it's closer to Markdown, and you could take a Markdown document and just paste it in paper and it'll format it the way you want it. And you can export it to Markdown as well. So
neat.
If you and I are ever writing a script, that's like rule number one. Okay. That shit is in Markdown. Like forget about Final Draft, like with a centered courier type. Like I'm not from the film industry, but I think we're going to have that argument.
It'll definitely be a debate. Yes.
Well, when it's ready for prime time, we can convert it.
Okay. That's fair. I can agree to that.
Yeah, man. Okay. So you're making this podcast and everything. And are you being systematic in how you market it and publish it and everything like that?
I'm going to say yes with an asterisk.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is each of us, each of the three collaborators, myself, Michael Goldberg, and Dave Chan, we're each posting it to our social media platforms. Usually multiple times for each episode, because as you know, especially on Twitter, the chances of someone in your circle seeing your tweet, you know,
it goes right by. They got to dip in the stream at the exact moment that you're there.
And, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we tend to, and I've created for each episode, I create a feature graphic. So we attach that to either the tweet or the Facebook post and tag one another. Quite a lot of the followers are other filmmakers. So they will quite often chime in and say, nice work, nice going, and they'll either retweet or reshare from Facebook. And there is a website, so everything gets posted there with as attractive a form as we can manage.
Right.
And not being designers, being filmmakers and not designers. And so it's systematic only in as much as we do the same things every time, but not necessarily the most strategic things every time.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to hear. I'm always interested to hear about other processes and that type of thing. All right, quick break today to tell you about our bandwidth sponsor for this episode, Freedcamp.com. Freedcamp is what I use to organize and plan episodes of the Busy Creator Podcast, and it's also how I organize client projects. And David just mentioned Trello, and well, let me tell you, Freedcamp is much better. You can set up swim lanes on Kanban boards, you can assign project phases, discuss topics outside of the individual action items, connect Google Drive and other applications, so many things. You can definitely plan a script using Freedcamp, especially if you're coordinating with other writers or producers. You can get them in on the projects, and you can manage your podcast episodes, which is
what I do. So thank you once again to Freedcamp for sponsoring the bandwidth of the Busy Creator podcast. Their website is freedcamp.com. That's freedcamp.com. And of course, I've got links to that on the show notes page for this episode, busycreator.com/96. Okay, let's get back into the conversation with David.
All right, so we kind of went out of order and we talked about your desk and everything. That's something I always ask about, is the home setup and what it looks like and physically about your desk. But obviously we're in your studio, which is pretty cool. But can you return there for the listeners, really talk about the gear that you've got here and your setup and how it all came together? And especially like if you built it yourself, if you bought all the parts on Craigslist used and cobbled it together. And how did this crazy battle station come together?
Sure. So the battle station is a collection of three LCD monitors that kind of came together over a long period of time. I bought one of them originally back in the 2004-2005 timeframe when widescreen monitors were just starting to be available on the market at affordable prices. And since then, I've added another larger one. I received a 19-inch square monitor from a friend who was moving to the West Coast several years ago and left this behind for me. So it, island of misplaced toys. Or, is that the expression?
Island of Misfit Toys, I think.
Island of Misfit Toys. And I'm currently running these monitors off of this next bit really still amazes me. I bought in 2009 a Dell computer, which was one of their state-of-the-art, most powerful boxes. Mm-hmm. In 2009, on my birthday, it arrived. And it's still going today.
Wow.
It's the first time in my adult life, because where we are with computers, that would preclude anything prior to it. It's the first time in my life that I've had a computer that's lasted 7 years, almost 7 years.
That's crazy.
Over 7 years. Yeah, it is pretty crazy. And it still does everything I need it to do. And I'm doing some pretty demanding things at times in terms of audio processing and video processing and, you know, rendering and all those kinds of complicated things that really put a lot of heat on your CPU. So it's still doing it all. I fully anticipate it's someday just going to give up entirely. But until that point, I'm going to grind it out.
Yeah. Well, what usually forces people to upgrade their PC, especially on the Windows and PC side, is gaming. And if you're trying to run the latest version of Crysis or whatever it is, I don't even know what games are popular.
Neither do I.
And then you plug it in and you say, oh, you need the Ivy Bridge chip or something like that.
Right.
Then that's the time when you go and buy yourself a new system. So, but hey, man, keep doing what you're doing. But on the Windows side of things, I mean, you're probably one of like maybe four or five people in the show that has
in the world
that has used Windows, and most creative pros, even across writing and everything else, are using Macs. And is that a deliberate choice? Or are you just waiting for this one to kind of die?
It has been mostly a deliberate choice. And the reason being, I have always been a Windows guy, always used Windows computers and Windows operating systems. So over that time, not only have I gotten very familiar with it and comfortable with it, I'm familiar with the under the hood portion of it as well. So the hardware is much less expensive than Mac hardware. You know, if I were to buy a Mac Pro right now, I could probably buy three Windows towers for the price of a single Mac Pro. Plus, I have a lot of money invested in software over the years that I've kind of upgraded every year or so.
Sure.
So in terms of audio recording software and audio production software and video editing software and all the plugins that go along with that, there's a fair investment in software that most of which I'd have to throw away.
Wow.
So there's a financial incentive as well as a familiarity issue.
Do they not offer cross-grade licenses?
That's a good question. It's something I haven't really investigated. One of the packages I use is for video editing is Sony Vegas Pro, which is no longer owned by Sony. It's now owned by a company called Magix. But Sony Vegas Pro or Vegas Pro is only for Windows.
Okay.
And the audio software I use is called Sonar by Cakewalk. And they are in the process of creating a Mac version. So there may be a cross-grade opportunity there. But I haven't gotten my head around the finances just yet.
Yeah. Well, I feel your pain again because I'm a Hackintosh user. And so when I put my tower together in 2012, not quite 2009, but definitely getting some years on that thing, it just passed its 4-year birthday, I suppose, and still kicking butt, still
That's
rocking.
Impressive.
But yeah, the price is just unbelievable. That I built that at the time, it was a top of the line tower for about $1,200. And I had a monitor and everything. So that was part of the purchase. But at that time, like like you're saying, the canister Mac, the little garbage can.
Yep.
I mean, those things are like $4,000. Like the only people that have them are essentially B2B studios, right? That professional studios where the regular designers probably don't even buy. Like, you know, you have an IT department and there's lots of big checks being written left and right.
Yeah.
So it's not the economical thing for the home DIY creative pro.
It's getting tougher and tougher.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Hackintosh is the way to go, if you're my opinion.
Amen.
But okay, so you got your computer. And how about any daily routines? Do you have any habits that you keep? And I mean, you work from home. Is that every time, every day?
Yes, it is every day now. My routines, one of my big passions and one of the things that keeps me physically and emotionally sane is exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So my routine right now is a workout first thing in the morning, pretty shortly after I wake. I'm at the gym for, 40 minutes or so, usually back home within an hour, and then kind of dig in right away. And it's usually right now, and it depends on where I am with a given project, but right now I'm in the midst of a new book. So I sit down and write, research, those kinds of things. I don't have really great habits when it comes to eating.
Okay.
You know, I do eat when I get back from the gym. Lunchtime tends to be pretty flexible. It tends to float more often than not have dinner with my wife in the evenings.
Okay.
So,
but does that work for you?
It does.
Do you forget to eat? I sometimes do that. Where you just look at the clock. You're like, it's 4:30. I guess I can't really have lunch now. It's, you know what I mean?
That does happen. And, you know, my wife is more concerned about it than I am. She's concerned for my well-being. So she'll quite often come to my office with a glass of water and say, please drink this water. Or here, I've made you a sandwich, please eat it. Because there are times, depending on how engrossed I am in a given project, I can just forget and like not even think about food or water, which, neither of which is a good thing.
Exactly, right. You're giving yourself to your art.
Right.
Quite literally.
Yeah. Suffering for the art.
Absolutely. Are you one of these folks that has a really rigid morning wake up time and you have to get up at 5:30 and do this type of thing, and you follow the guidance of some of these gurus and authors?
I don't. No. I don't have anything really rigid. I have, since I left corporate America, I purposely do not wake to an alarm. So I go to bed, around the same time every night and wake up approximately the same time every day, but
right.
Not to an alarm. Like, okay. I'm just, is to the extent I can, I never have to do that again, I'll be happy. Wake up on my own, kind of make my way to the gym. When I come back from the gym, more often than not, I meditate for 15 minutes before I eat. Forgot to mention that.
Okay.
So before I eat, I meditate, eat, have a coffee, and then kind of dive into the day.
All right. Keeping it regimented.
Yeah, as best I can. Yeah.
Yeah. How about information diet? Is there certain websites you like to read and keep up with the film industry or the audio industry and anything like that?
I'm a little odd in that regard, in as much as I don't read the news.
Uh-huh.
I do subscribe to New York Times e-blasts and CNN e-blasts. So anything that's usually terrible in the world, I get to hear about fairly soon after it's happened. But I don't actively seek out news. Also subscribe to many, a lot of industry stuff in terms of the, both audio and video. So I do kind of have a decent idea what's going on without actively reading a lot of lengthy blog posts.
Yeah, that's always interesting. Everyone's different, right? And they say, I have an hour bus ride, so I just read articles on my phone. And I'm thinking, that's a terrible way to live. But meanwhile, I'm sitting there in front of my RSS feeds, two or three times a day, like way more than I should. So we're all different. I mean, that's kind of the theme.
It could be
right?
worse. You could be watching TV. You could be watching The View or some kind of reality show.
Goodness. I have an antenna. I don't have cable. And it's not about me. I just want to mention real quick. I have this antenna and I watch one broadcast a year. And it's the Oscars. Nothing else on broadcast TV. Everything else, I'll catch it at a later time, download it on the computer.
Right.
It'll be edited. It'll have no commercials, except the Oscars. That's the one I like to participate live and tweet live and everything. Except, we did watch the presidential debates the other day. But even then, I connected my computer and I watched the Twitter streamed version.
Ah.
So I didn't even watch the broadcast version.
Interesting.
There you go. Yeah, man. So how about, I didn't even ask this about your sort of business setup. Like, do you have a conglomerate or do you have a confederacy with other folks and you team up on projects and then, that type of thing, like you're contractors for one another? And I mean, this is called the Hollywood model, where you assemble for a project.
Another good question, Prescott. I've only been out of the corporate world for a little over 3 months.
Oh, wow.
Closing in on 4 months. So as far as collaborations and the way I collaborate, I don't really have a pattern for that yet.
Okay.
So this may be a dead end. I'm open to whatever comes up. And if there's anyone listening who'd like to collaborate, I am more than open to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are you struggling with then, even in those first 3 months? Is there something that you're really identified and you're looking to overcome and you're looking to build better habits?
In terms of the practice, the one thing I can say about myself without any sense of arrogance is that I'm good at focus. I'm good at sticking to the work and getting the work done.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm happy to say is a strength of mine. Where I need to spend more time is in things like networking and marketing.
Yeah.
And those are kind of areas that I'm not afraid of, but I just don't have the practice or experience to know exactly where to go and who to speak to and how to get my word out there and how to build a following. So those are things I'm working on and maybe even struggling with a little bit right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Okay. I know what that's like. Yeah. All right. Well, how can folks catch up with you, see some of your work, hear your podcasts, collaborate on a script? I mean, everything else that you're doing, how can we get in touch?
I can be contacted at my website at davidpower.com. The Surefire podcast is at surefirepodcast.com.
All right.
It's also available on Stitcher and iTunes under the same name, Sure-Fire podcast. And I can be reached by email at david@davidpower.com.
Okay, great. And we'll have all that linked to the show notes as well, so don't have to memorize it out there if you're listening. But David, thanks a lot for your time and for illuminating some of the projects you're working on.
You're quite welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Absolutely. All right, take care.
Thanks.
Yeah, okay, that was David. And good chat there. And I think what I failed to mention explicitly is that everything David does now is self-taught and pretty much started as an after-hours project, so on the side. And many of us creatives enjoy doing other things outside of our main practice, but it can seem overwhelming, so definitely take some inspiration from him. And he just started. He just starts chipping away bit by bit on those other endeavors, and next thing you know, he's doing all the things. Now, as I mentioned, I've got links to everything we discussed over at the show notes page, busycreator.com/96. Once again, that's busycreator.com/96. And that's where you can leave us a comment, get in touch with David, hear his podcast, watch a few videos, and learn about everything that the Busy Creator has to offer. Next time on the podcast, I speak with Michael Stinson about typography and his company, TypeEd.
With the onslaught of UI, UX, and everything going digital. So when they get out there in the industry and they get really good, like a digital agency does, then they're asked to do more on the print side. That's when they find out that they don't know enough and they come to us.
And that episode will be released in 2 weeks. Make sure you subscribe in iTunes, Google Play Music, or on your phone's podcast app, or wherever you download podcasts, actually, so you don't miss future episodes. Yeah, come find us. You have been listening to the Busy Creator Podcast, a production of Starship Design, offering strategy and design to intelligent brands. Our website is starship.design. The Busy Creator's theme song was composed by Joaquin Kotler. Check him out at joaquinkotler.com. I'm Prescott Perez Fox, and thank you for listening to the Busy Creator Podcast. I'm hanging out online, so come connect with me. And until next time, get busy and create. I'm Prescott Perez. What the hell is my name?